You can be opening in your Bibles to 1 Peter chapter 1. That will be our text for this evening, 1 Peter 1. Thank you again for the invitation and for letting me be a part of things this weekend. I really am already just very encouraged by getting to know you all. I love what you put together this afternoon for the young people and for each other just to spend time together and think about things that matter. And I'm thankful that you have shown interest in what we started talking about last night. If you were not with us last night, you are kind of coming into the second part of a conversation that began then. Here's the brief idea. I believe that the first century Christians were zealous and excited and understood who they were, not because they were reading a bunch of things that were in the New Testament. That wasn't written yet. That was being written as time went on for them. But part of the reason they were so excited about the work that was being done in the early church is because they knew the Old Testament better than we do in many ways. And because they spent a lot of time looking at what was predicted, what was prophesied, what was described about their salvation and what the Lord would do with them in their life, I believe that they were inspired by those images. And I took some time yesterday to try to convince you that this is a biblical way to approach thinking about Christianity. Jesus, in Luke 24, when he was walking with those men on the road to Emmaus, he caused their hearts to burn within them as he shared the Old Testament scriptures about the Messiah. And then Jesus said at the end of that conversation, at the end of Luke 24, that there were many things in the Old Testament written about him, that he would suffer, that he would rise again on the third day, and that repentance and forgiveness of sins would be proclaimed to all nations. And that, by the way, is about us. That we are part of the prophetic Old Testament message. That we have a place in the preaching of the suffering and the resurrection of Jesus. And then we went to 2 Peter chapter 3 and 1 Peter 1, where we are here. And we pointed out that Peter told Christians to think about what the prophets said. He pointed them backwards and said, I want you to remember the words spoken beforehand by the prophets. And in that text in 2 Peter 3, he said it was the second time that he had mentioned it. The first time is here in 1 Peter 1. Let me remind you of that. Look at verse 10. And remember, verses 10 through 12 are kind of a parenthetical. You'll see that here in a moment when we look at the rest of the chapter. But Peter said, as to this salvation, the prophets who prophesied of the grace that would come to you made careful searches and inquiries, seeking to know what person or time the Spirit of Christ within them was indicating as he predicted the sufferings of Christ and the glories to follow. It was revealed to them that they were not serving themselves, but you in these things, which now have been announced to you through those who preach the gospel to you by the Holy Spirit sent from heaven, things into which angels long to look. What we find out in those couple of verses is that our salvation was both prophesied by the prophets, and remember the language, they prophesied of the grace that would come to us. You can go to the Old Testament and find all kinds of wonderful descriptions of God's grace, not just to the Israelites of old, but to us as the Messiah's people. He also says there, did you catch the language? I wanted to show you this. Look at the end of verse 11. You see where it says that they predicted the sufferings of Christ and, what does your version say at the end of verse 11? The glories that would follow. Now, yeah, there's Isaiah 53 that described the suffering of Christ, but there are a lot of Old Testament passages that describe the glories that followed. That's our glory. That's our grace. That's our story. Tonight, we're going to look at how Peter uses that same idea in his chapter here as he describes our salvation. Go back to verse 3. Let me show you the image of our salvation that Peter chooses to discuss in this chapter. Verse 3 says, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his great mercy has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. As Peter begins to describe our salvation, he uses this language of being born again. Now, you've heard that before. We've talked about that. In fact, a lot of religious people use this phrase, don't they? Have you ever heard somebody say, or has anybody ever asked you, are you a born-again Christian? You ever had that question asked you? Now, normally when people ask that nowadays, they're distinguishing between Catholic and Protestant. That's what they're saying. When they say, are you born again, they mean, were you baptized as a baby? Or were you later in your life sort of regenerated or born again in some way as an adult? That's normally what people are talking about. But the idea of being born again, in our minds, most of the time brings with it the idea of getting to start over, doesn't it? You know, the great news about being born again is you get to begin again and start a new life. You know, I think you'll find this interesting. But in all of the first chapter of 1 Peter, he never brings that up about being born again. He never says, hey, the good news about being born again is you get to start over. He's going to tell us a whole bunch of other things that are true if we've been born again. A whole bunch of other benefits, not just getting to start over, but something a little deeper. In fact, if you've got a different version, like the New King James, it doesn't say you've been born again, does it? Some versions say God has begotten you again. Anybody's version say something like that? The focus of that verse is not on our new start, but on God being the Father. That's the emphasis. He's the begetter of our new life. Now, we're going to talk more about what that means in just a moment, but now skip to verse 23. And notice how verse 3 and verse 23 sound similar. When he gets to the end of the chapter, he says, for you have been born again. Not of seed which is perishable, but imperishable. That is through the living and enduring word of God. You see how verse 3 and verse 23 both bring up being born again. Everything in between those two bookends describes our salvation in terms of having a new father. What does it mean that we've been born again? Now, notice one other thing. The next verse, verse 24, quotes the Old Testament. You see that? He gets to the end of the chapter and he says, for all flesh is like grass, and all the glory, all its glory is like the flower of grass. The grass withers, the flower falls off, but the word of the Lord endures forever, and this is the word which was preached to you. Peter, at the end of this discussion of being born again in our salvation, brings up Isaiah chapter 40 to prove his point. Why? We're going to look at that at the end of the lesson. I want you to be thinking about it, though. Do you remember Jesus ever having a conversation about being born again? You remember that? John chapter 3. There was a man named what who came to him at night? Nicodemus. Nicodemus was a teacher, a Pharisee, a rabbi. He'd heard and seen Jesus doing some things, and he came and he said, listen, teacher, you've got to be from God because nobody could do these things unless you're from God. Now, if I was Jesus, I would have given him a hug and said, I'm so glad you finally noticed. But Jesus pushed back a little bit. And he did say to Nicodemus, unless you are born again, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Remember that? Nicodemus was confused. And he said, how can a man be born when he's old? A man can't climb back into his mother's womb, can he? I don't know if he was trying to be funny or if he just didn't understand at all what was going on. Jesus said something to Nicodemus that for a long time I just missed. About verse 10 of John 3, Jesus said, are you a teacher of Israel and you don't know these things? Have you ever thought about that? How could Jesus rebuke an Old Testament teacher for not understanding the idea of being born again? You know what the answer is? It wasn't a New Testament idea. It wasn't something Jesus just came up with. It wasn't something that sometimes we think that you never read about being born again until you get to the new covenant. No, the prophets described it. It was something that was predicted. The story of our being born again was written long before, and the teachers of Israel should have known it. I think by the time we're done, you'll see that when the first century Christians thought about being born again, their picture was bigger than ours. They didn't just think, oh good, I get to start over. They thought of a richer, deeper, fuller understanding of what it meant to have God as their Father. So, let's go through it. Go back to the beginning of chapter 1 of 1 Peter, and let's begin to see the benefit of being born again. Verse 4 says, to obtain an inheritance which is imperishable and undefiled and will not fade away, reserved in heaven for you. If you've been born again and you have a new father, here's the first benefit. Now, the first benefit might be verse 3 that says a living hope, and that's fine. But when you get to verse 4, he says, here's the good news. You have a new inheritance. And it's a great inheritance, imperishable, undefiled, and will not fade away. Let me talk about your earthly father for a minute. How many of you already received your earthly inheritance from your earthly father? Some of you? Your father died. And whatever it was that he had, he left you. I was recently visiting my dad. Actually, the last couple of times I've seen him back in San Diego, he's made it a point to take me aside and say, you know, I'm getting older, and I want to tell you about what I want when I die. Last time he told me he wanted me to take his ashes and mix them into a concrete block and throw them in the ocean. That's what he told me. But he pointed around the house and he said, you know, when I die, all this will be yours. You think I was excited about that? It really actually gave me a headache when I was thinking about it. I was thinking about all the things I'd have to clean up and all the fishing gear that I'd have to untangle. But depending on who your father is, your earthly father, it might be really good news. He might leave you something substantial. But here's the problem with it. No matter what it is, it'll disappear. It'll go away. In fact, some of you that received it, it's already gone, isn't it? What does it mean? And what do you think it meant to people of the first century who maybe weren't born into a family with anything? Their father was nobody to speak of, wouldn't leave them anything. What do you think it meant to them when they were told, you've got this new father, and your inheritance is everything that's his? Is that something to be grateful for? But you know, when I've thought about being born again in the past, that's not what I think of. I think of, I get to start over. No, think about what's coming in your inheritance. That's the first benefit. Let's look at the second one in the next verse. Verse 5 says, who are protected by the power of God through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. If you have a new father, not only do you have his imperishable inheritance, now you have his powerful protection. Again, go back to the first century mentality. If you were born into a family that wasn't Roman or wasn't powerful, and you were maybe even an orphan or just from a poor place, did you have much protection from the things that could harm you? What do you think it meant to somebody who became part of a family that was powerful? And you would have their financial protection and their sort of their political protection. That would mean something. Look at what's being said. If you've been born again, you've got a father who protects you by his power. What do you think that means? Do you think people misuse that verse? You ever heard a TV preacher say something like, if God's your father, if you've got God in your life, nothing bad's ever going to happen to you. You know, financially you'll be all right, and you're going to be protected from all kinds of stuff. You ever heard that kind of thing? They might go to a verse like this. I think it's clear in the next couple verses that's not at all what Peter means. If it means that God puts some sort of bubble around us and nothing bad ever happens, I don't know why the next couple verses talk about trials like fire. But maybe Peter means something else. Notice the language. You're protected by the power of God through, what does your verse say? Faith. Let's see if I can illustrate that. I have two boys that are now teenagers. I would like for you to congratulate me on keeping them alive until now, because I didn't know that I was going to be able to do that. As a father, though, I took seriously, I think, protecting them by my power, whatever limitations I have, my wisdom, my ability to provide, my insight into the way the world worked, I wanted to protect them. Would you believe me if I told you that I locked them in a closet and never let them out? That that was my plan? Of course not. Now, I've met some parents that do that, but that doesn't always work the way we think. I believe, though, that my way of protecting my kids is a lot like what I learned from the Father. When my son Cade was about 4 or 5 years old, we had just moved to Minnesota, and we were living on a busy street. It used to be that where we lived in California was in a parking lot of a church building. The church there in at Lassen Street in Sepulveda, North Hills, had a parsonage, like a preacher's house. And so the kids got to play outside, and it was sort of just the church property. They weren't used to streets, and so little Cade began to run toward the street. And I was standing up by the house, and I looked up, and I saw a car coming, and that little boy was about to run out in front of it. So me, with my vision that he didn't have, my understanding of what could happen that he didn't get, I yelled, "Stop!" Just like that. And that little boy stopped right at the edge of the street, and the car went by. Did I protect him by my power? And the answer is I did. I knew things he didn't know. I spoke up about things that could hurt him. But do you know what really saved that little boy? Faith. He heard the voice of his Father, and he trusted me. And when he trusted my voice, he obeyed me. And when he obeyed me, he stayed out of harm. You know, that's exactly what the book of 1 Peter teaches. That if we've got a Father who we love, you're going to read more in this book about obedience than just about any other book. Be obedient children. Do what God says. Don't go running out with people in chapter 4 to all the things they run out to. They don't know that they're going out to destroy themselves. You obey God. And when we have faith in God, we are protected by his power. What a benefit that is. So if you've been born again, you've got his inheritance, his powerful protection. Let's read the next section. Starting in verse 6. In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you've been in distress by various trials, so that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And though you have not seen him, you love him. And though you do not see him now, but believe in him, you greatly rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, obtaining as the outcome of your faith the salvation of your souls. You know, if I could give you one word to describe the idea of this section, it would be the word discipline. That God, who wants to give us the inheritance, who protects us by his power, does not keep anything bad from happening to us. And if you ever meet somebody that thinks God's power means they're not going to go through trials, show them this text. Because it speaks of his power in verse 5, and then trials like fire in verse 6, and God just lets us go through them. But God does that to teach us, so that we can become better and improve. You know, there are different parenting philosophies. Maybe you had this in your own marriage, but for me and my wife, as the boys were growing up, she tended to be a little bit more like, I'm not going to let them try that, because I think they could hurt themselves. And I was always the one that said, let's watch what happens. Now, just to be clear, I didn't let him run in the street in front of the car. Remember that. But if he was going to step off a step or go up a ramp or do something, I'd kind of wait and see what happened. Now, sometimes it didn't work out so well for him. But they learned something from that. You know, God's always been in the business of letting us live lives in a world that's pretty dangerous, instructing us, telling us to trust, telling us to be obedient, but he doesn't protect us from all harm. You know why? Because he loves us. Hebrews 12 says, "He whom the Father loves, he disciplines. No discipline for the moment seems joyful, but in the end it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness." You know, the illustration here is gold being purified. Let me see if I can make another illustration. Let's say I was hiking somewhere out here, came across something that looked like gold, and I picked it up, a rock, and I took it to a goldsmith, you know, a jeweler who knew something about this, and I said, "I just want confirmation. Is this gold?" And they test it, and they said, "It is gold." And I said, "Good, give it back." And they said, "No, you let me have it." Wouldn't it be foolish if when they took out that hammer and began to smash my rock, if I said, "Stop, what are you doing? Don't harm my rock." They would say, "You don't understand. I'm making it better." And after they, you know, took off many of the impurities, I'd say, "Give it back." And they'd say, "No, we're not done yet." And they'd heat up a cauldron with a fire, really hot. And they'd throw my precious gold into this thing. And I'd say, "What are you doing? You're killing it." And they'd say, "No, I'm not. I'm making it better." Aren't you thankful that you have a Father now that you've been born again? That understands that in your life. That knows how to instruct you and teach you and perfect you and put just enough situations in your life that he can continue to purify you in your faith. How many kids grew up without discipline? How many people do you know that didn't have a father like that? Being born again means you've got all of that. Peter's not done. This is about the time Peter stops and says, "Hey, the prophets that prophesied of this grace, they said some things about this," but that's the parenthetical. So skip over it to verse 13. And let's continue on with the discussion of what does it mean if we've got a new father. Verse 13 says, "Therefore, prepare your minds for action, keep sober in spirit, fix your hope completely on the grace to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. As obedient children, do not be conformed to the former lusts which were yours in your ignorance, but like the Holy One who called you, be holy yourselves also in all your behavior, because it is written, 'You shall be holy, for I am holy.'" You know what this text teaches? Is that if we've got a new father, we have a new example and a new identity and a new person to look up to and emulate. How many of you, don't raise your hands, how many of you, though, really want to imitate your earthly parents? Some of you might. Some of you might look at your moms and your dads and say, "I want to be just like them." Chances are, though, when you were growing up and you looked at their faults, you said something like, "I'm never going to say that to my kids." And then you had kids and you said it anyway. But think of how wonderful it is when you finally have a father that can look at you and say, "You be just like me." He'll never say, "Do as I say, not as I do." He'll just always say, "Be like me." Is that a benefit? You ever seen a kid that was adopted? I love people that will do that. They'll take children in, whether that be adoption or fostering or anything. A kid that's not had the easiest of lives and gone through some things. You ever seen one of those children maybe that came from another country, though, and they'd grown up for a while there? They'd been in an orphanage or whatever. And they're brought over after living for a while and put into a new family. You ever seen that? There's a lot of hard stuff that goes on. Kids are survivors, and they're not sure if they're really ready to trust. And sometimes there's struggles within that. But have you ever seen this? Have you ever seen the day that comes where a kid's finally convinced, finally, that they are loved and that their parents are good, and they look up one day and say, "Dad, you're a good man and I want to be just like you"? This is what we have. If we've been born again, this is part of our story. And it's not just that we get to start over. It's that we get to look up to him and be holy like he is holy. Keep going. Peter has more to say about what we have. Verse 17. If you address as Father the one who impartially judges according to each one's work, conduct yourselves in fear during the time of your stay on earth, knowing that you were not redeemed with perishable things like silver or gold from your futile way of life inherited from your forefathers, but with precious blood, as of a lamb unblemished and spotless, the blood of Christ. For he was foreknown before the foundation of the world, but has appeared in these last times for the sake of you, who through him are believers in God, who raised him from the dead and gave him glory, so that your faith and hope are in God. Now notice that we're still talking about having a father. You see the language there? If you call this one your father because you've been born again, here's some things that are true. Two things in this text. Number one, he is impartial. Do you appreciate that? It may depend on how you grew up. Anybody grow up in a family where your parents were partial? Like you just were certain that they loved your sister more than you, or your brother, that you were favorite. Or, this is even worse, is if you were the favorite. God says to everybody that's his children, here's the thing, with me, you don't have to worry about that. I'm not going to let you off the hook just because you think you're my favorite. But on the other hand, I'm not going to treat somebody better than you because you think they're my favorite. What a blessing it is to have a father who's impartial. What's the other thing the text teaches? Well, that God making us his children is like adoption, that we were redeemed or purchased. That's the picture. But the cost of the adoption was not silver and gold, but what? The blood of the very Son of God. What if you found out someday that you were adopted? Maybe some of you did. You grew up not really knowing, and then at some point your parents said, by the way, you were adopted. And they weren't joking with you, like some parents do. They meant it. You were adopted. Would it matter to you what the backstory was? Like if somebody said, you know, we adopted you, but we really didn't want you. Somebody dropped you on the doorstep and there just wasn't anybody else and we just sort of took you in. Maybe that would still impress you. What if somebody told you, we wanted you and we saw that you were across the sea and we saved all this money and spent thousands and thousands of dollars on a lawyer and on plane fees. We stayed in China for a month to qualify, and we chose you. Would that impress you? How much money would it take? But it's even more than that. Let me see if I can illustrate this. Let's say that one of these young boys gets in a whole heap of trouble in their life. Life goes wrong, and they end up in jail. And they burn every bridge, you know. I've got two boys, and I love them. And we didn't think we'd ever have them. I'm thankful that I've got them. But let's say that that boy who was in prison and didn't have a future, I came to him and said, here's the deal. I'm going to give you every opportunity in your life. The only way it can be done is my son take your place. So I take all that I was going to give him and I give it to you. Let's say that that young man went and lived his life, went to college on my dime, was given every freedom. And if I showed up and said, hey, how are you doing? How are you doing in school? Do you think they could look me in the eye if they weren't doing all they could? If they knew what it cost me? Do you suppose sometimes our Father above sheds tears because those that he's redeemed at such a high cost don't understand it? If you've been born again, you have his inheritance, his protection, his discipline, his example, his impartiality, his high cost adoption. And one more thing. Next verse. Verse 22 says, Since you have in obedience to the truth purified your souls for a sincere love of the brethren, fervently love one another from the heart, for you have been born again. You know what verse 22 teaches? If you've got a new father, you've got a new what? Family. This isn't just about you and him. And that's actually one of the problems with some people talking about being born again. I've been born again. It's me and God, my new life. No, God's done this for a family, and you belong to the family. And Peter actually says what comes with being part of this new family is that you got to love each other. I wish he'd have just said that, don't you? But he didn't just say love one another. He said love one another fervently. I wish he'd have stopped there, but he didn't. He said, love one another fervently from the heart. I have a really tough question for you. When did you stop doing that? And I that's mean, but I'm being honest. When did you stop doing that? Do you remember when you first became a Christian? Do you remember when you first came up out of the water and you loved everybody? You were so excited about your new family. And then somebody hurt you. Somebody disappointed you. Somebody brought you low. And then you became choosy about who you'd love. I love them, but not them. I'll say I love them, but I'm not sure if it's fervent. I'll love them on the outside, but I'm not sure if it's from the heart. Look, the only way we get back to that is by understanding who our Father is. Not who our family is, but who our Father is. Now, I don't know about you, but that's not how I've thought about being born again most of my life. All I've ever thought is, I get to start over. Yes, you do. But you have all of the riches of this discussion in your life. Where'd it come from? Who thought of this? Was it just Peter being clever and preaching a sermon? Was it just, you know, one person's idea about what it means to be a Christian? Or do you think that the first century Christians got a hold of this and they understood the image of what it meant to be born again? Let's go find where it comes from. Let's go to Isaiah 40, the text that Peter quotes. Let's see if we maybe can see what they saw. Isaiah chapter 40. Now, we're going to read a little bit here in this chapter, but I want to put it in its context of in the book of Isaiah. There's a lot of different ways to organize Isaiah, but I'm going to give you one that's a helpful, I think, way to picture the book of Isaiah. How many books are in the Bible? How many books in the Bible? 66. Good, you know that, don't you? How many chapters in Isaiah? You want to guess? 66. 66 books of the Bible, 66 chapters in Isaiah. How many books are in the Old Testament? Anybody know that? 39. That leaves 27 books in the New. In our Bibles, there's a division between Old and New. By the way, in Isaiah, the major division of the book is exactly the same. You've got 39 chapters of one thing, and then 27 chapters of another. But this gets even more interesting. The first 39 chapters of Isaiah, here are the themes. Number one, God is holy. Number two, his people have fallen short of his holiness. And number three, because of that, there is judgment. What would you say the theme of the Old Testament is? It's very much like that, isn't it? God's holy, the people fall short, and there's judgment. But the second half of Isaiah, beginning in chapter 40, changes its tune. Now God is gracious, and God is going to send a servant who is going to extend that grace to the people. And there's hope. Or in other words, the second half of Isaiah is a lot like the New Testament. What you essentially have is that Isaiah is the Bible in miniature form. I don't know if that's providence or coincidence, but it sure is interesting. And right here in chapter 40, it gets even more interesting because it's like the beginning of the New Testament. Let's read it. And notice how much it sounds like the New Testament beginning when you read Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. Verse 1. Comfort, O comfort my people, says your God. Speak kindly to Jerusalem and call out to her that her warfare is ended, that her iniquity has been removed, that she has received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins. Stop there. First words. Comfort, O comfort my people. Do you know why you have to say that in chapter 40, verse 1? Because it's been 39 chapters of being uncomfortable. It's been judgment and punishing for sins. And now God says, the time has come, the time has come where I'm going to speak differently to you, my people. I'm going to offer you the comfort that I've been promising. Keep reading. Verse 3. A voice is calling. Clear the way for the Lord in the wilderness. Make smooth in the desert a highway for our God. Let every valley be lifted up and every mountain and hill be made low, and let the rough ground become a plain and the rugged terrain a broad valley. Now, those of you that are Bible students, what's that talking about? Who's verse 3? John the Baptist. In fact, when you read the New Testament Gospels, this is the verse that's quoted. This is what John himself said about himself. I am the voice crying in the wilderness. So when Isaiah says, hey, God's going to comfort his people, the first thing you're going to see is a voice that comes and gets the way ready, prepares everybody. Well, look at the way it's described, the preparation. There in verse 4, every valley lifted up, every mountain be made low, rough places becoming a plain. You see that? If on your way home tonight, by the way, it seems pretty flat here to me, but I assume there's some low places and some high places. But let's say you looked over and there was somebody with tractors. And what they were doing was they were bringing the high places low, and they were bringing the low places high, and they were making that rough area a plain. What would you expect was about to happen? Somebody's going to build something. Either a highway, which, by the way, Isaiah will speak of, the highway of holiness. Or they're going to build a structure, like a temple or a house. And that's exactly what John the Baptist was doing, getting ready for the building project of the one who would come to build his church. Now, maybe there's more to the imagery of this, the valleys being lifted and the hills being brought low. Maybe it's talking about people, that Jesus was the great equalizer. If you're powerful, James chapter 1 says, let the rich glory in his humiliation. Let those that are low glory in their exaltation. Jesus was going to bring the low up and the rich down, and he was going to put everybody on the same plane. But that's one image. We're not even at the place that Peter quotes yet. Look at the next verse. After John the Baptist, what was going to happen? Verse 5. Then the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all flesh will see it together, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. Now, what does that verse mean? It does not say that all flesh will see him, but all flesh will see it. What's this glory of the Lord that everybody was going to see? But of course, we know in the New Testament that we're talking about Jesus. How do we know that? John 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his, what? Glory. Glory of the only begotten. The glory of God that man had never seen with their eyes, but Jesus revealed it. Here you have a prophecy that said, after the preparation, everybody was going to see the Messiah, the glory of God, Jesus himself. All right. Now what happens next has always been interesting to me. Listen to the prophecy of Isaiah. Verse 6 says, a voice says, call out. Then he answered, what shall I call out? By the way, calling out is like preaching. Isaiah is given this vision of what's going to happen. and something in the vision says, preach, call out. And the question comes, what do you want me to say? What is preaching about the Messiah sound like? What's the message to present to mankind? Here's the answer. And it's Peter's quote. Read it. All flesh is grass, and all its loveliness is like the flower of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades when the breath of the Lord blows upon it. Surely the people are grass. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever. Does that sound like good news to you? It doesn't sound really very gospel-y at all at first. In fact, let me say it to you in modern English. Listen up. You're all going to die. You're all going to die. Like grass and flowers, the breath of the Lord's going to blow on you and you're going to go away. Good news, right? You know why that's going to happen? Because you've been born of corruptible seed. That's what Peter said. We were not born of corruptible seed, but imperishable seed. Your earthly father gave you life with perishable seed. Now that gets a little confusing in the English, but in the Spanish, I have a Spanish preaching friend. He says, what do you guys do with 1 Peter 1, 22 and 23? It's awkward in the Spanish. Why? Because it's talking about human biological seed, like of your dad. But here's the image. If you've just been born of flesh, you know what you are? Temporary. That doesn't sound like good news. Did you hear the good news in it, though? But the word of the Lord, what? Is forever. I missed it, guys. I didn't see it when I read Isaiah 40. Until Peter came along and said, you know what, guys? That's exactly what the Bible said. If all you are is corruptible seed, you will die. But if you're born again by the word of God, and this is the word that was preached to you, you will be born again, and there will be hope. And you'll have something to look forward to. And everything will change for you. Folks, that is the gospel. And it's not something that we see unless we understand the way that the prophets painted the image and the way the New Testament writers would point us back and say, pay attention to what they said. You know, the next couple verses, look at verse 9. Get yourself up on a high mountain, O Zion, bearer of good news. Lift up your voice mightily, O Jerusalem, bearer of good news. Lift it up, do not fear. Say to the cities of Judah, here is your God. Or in other words, Christian, start talking about this. When you finally get a hold of the idea, it doesn't matter who your father is, whether he's rich or whether he's poor, whether you think he's got your back or whether you think he doesn't, whether you're going to inherit something from him or not, here's the reality. You're all going to die, but we know something. We know about our Father who can beget you again. And I want to tell you about that. And every benefit that comes with it. Thanks for your attention tonight. I know that gives you a lot to think about. I know you'll have to wrestle through a text that you've read before. And I hope and I assume that many of you perhaps seen some of that. But it took me a while to begin looking at what the prophets said, listening to what Peter instructed, putting together the images with the teaching. But it's enriched my life. It's helped my ability to think of others in the right way and to tell them all the rich things about God. We'll do more of this tomorrow morning, but thank you again. If there's somebody here that has not been born again, I'll say something Peter didn't. You know what? You can start over. You can begin, and that's a great idea. But more than that,
You'll have a God who loves you, who will give you everything someday, who will discipline you and protect you, who will give you a family that you can love fervently from your heart, and you will be imperishable because you've been born by imperishable seed. Please consider coming to Him. If you need prayer or any other help tonight, let us know how we can help you while we stand and sing.